This is an MUT Radio podcast.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. This is yet another conversation with one of our researchers at MUT. Today, I'm having a conversation with Dr. Mvuyana. Doc, please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thank you, Prof. My name is Dr. BYC Mvuyana. I joined MUT in 2009. And at that time when I joined, I had an honors degree. Mm-hmm. I then registered in 2010 for a master's degree, of which I completed it in that year. And then in 2019, I graduated for my PhD. I'm currently the head of the department in the Department of Public Administration and Economics.
Dr. Mvuyana, I know you have touched a little bit on your academic journey at MUT. Just a little bit on your research journey.
My research journey started when I was doing my master's degree. I had an interest that I was focusing on rural-urban migration, which then lends itself on housing delivery. And at that time, I realized that South Africa has a challenge in terms of the huge housing backlog that, again, it was facing at the time. The interest rose. I then, again, when I was registering for my PhD, focused on a sustainable human settlements, where, again, their approach was brought in by the new programs or strategies which are adopted by the Department of Human Settlements. 2004, the Breaking New Ground was adopted, which was about bridging the gap in terms of housing delivery. We all know that post-1994, the focus was on delivering houses in mass production. Yeah. And again, it was guided by the Reconstruction and the Development Program, which was adopted in 1994. There were issues at the time which were about spatial planning. You know, if you look at townships like Umlazi, they were established far from the peripheries. And then again, that was the idea of the apartheid government. And then in 2004, guided by the Housing Act of 1997, the Department of Human Settlements felt that there is the need of integrating communities, where it was about making sure that houses are built close to economic opportunities and the beneficiaries, again, which is the poor, must be accommodated, where again, they need to make sure that they live close to where they work. When they travel, they don't spend long hours. They don't, there's not too much cost in terms of paying for the transport. However, the challenges that the country is facing is that even now, the informal settlements are sprawling every day. And these informal settlements are caused by the rapid urbanization that we see, apart from the migration of people coming from outside the country. If you look at the reports that have been published by the United Nations, they are telling that by 2050, 60% of the world will be urbanized. And that is saying countries as well as cities must have strategies in place to deal with that exodus. If you look at the Etegwini municipality, if you read the IDP, which is the Integrated Development Plan, they do indicate that for them to address the housing backlog, it's going to take them 90 years, which then says there must be strategies in place. And what they are doing again, the city, is it is that they need to make sure that they align all their programs with the national priorities as well as the international standards. And that brought an interest in terms of saying, how can, again, from the academic space, how can we then assist in making sure that these challenges are addressed? But it looks like the net is widening, because as we speak, we have illegal immigrants who are benefiting from the system. Now, cities are faced with a lot of challenges, where you find that as we are seeing this exodus, to the cities, the infrastructure, the resources, they get overstretched. Mm. And then we end up seeing the cities not being able to meet their mandate. So my role as a researcher, it is to look at how can the city be assisted in addressing these challenges. And what has been happening, or what is happening currently, it is that there's this issue of compliance in terms of engaging communities, citizen participation. Mm-hmm. But for me, what I'm looking at currently, it is how can the bottom-up approach be implemented where communities are able to participate in the space of decision-making, where at the end of the day, we make sure that there's meaningful consultation from the municipalities. And participatory planning, for me, it is at the center where I'm saying, whilst in the space of addressing issues that are affecting communities, but it should always be about the needs of the communities, not about what the municipality wants to deliver at the end.
You know, what you have said, most of us have been affected by it. It resonates with most of us. And from what you've said, it looks like the community must be at the center of decision making, especially because they are affected by some of these policy decisions that have been taken, and in some instances, not necessarily policy decisions. Mm. So have you been able, via your research, to collaborate with some members of the communities in Durban or anywhere else?
What is happening currently, I did a research which was focusing on the new strategy of building mega projects. And the project that I was focusing on, it was the Konobia. Mm-hmm. It was called a catalytic project because it was a pilot by the presidency, where the Department of Human Settlements again was saying, in terms of the plan, they're going to partner with Hewlett. And they bought a half of the land, which was owned by Hewlett. And the focus was to make sure that it's going to be a mixed-use development. Mm. Now, in terms of a mixed-use development, you're saying within the same project, there's going to be, they're going to accommodate the low-income group, which is food falls under the BNG. Mm-hmm. And then you also accommodate the middle-income group, the group that cannot qualify for the BNG. Mm-hmm. And then within the same project, you're going to make sure that there are industrial areas, there are recreational centers, all the amenities are there. And also it is close to economic opportunities. The one that I'm referring to, it is close to Mount Edgecombe. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was conducting that research, what I realized was that it looks like the beneficiaries do not really understand why are they relocated from a particular informal settlement, where you find that some of them had to travel 40 kilometers back to where they work every day. So some end up taking a decision of going back to the informal settlement rather than living to this formal housing, which again, I think the starting point for us, and I always say this wherever I go, even internationally, that in South Africa, housing is a human right. Yeah. And government has a responsibility of realizing that right. Now, in terms of my research, what I am doing currently, it is to capacitate to create awareness to communities in terms of making them understand why is government ensuring that at the end of the day, even the poor of the poorest does have access to formal housing. And I have done that in different ways, where there's a project that I've just registered with a CAD. Mm-hmm. Which again is on the Cornobia project, where for me now it is about saying, now that we know what is happening in this development, my role as a researcher, it is about capacitating the community, teaching them about the human rights, why housing is a human right, why must, as a beneficiary of this project, make sure that I maintain this house. Where does the money come from? Why is it important for me as a beneficiary at the end to hold a title deed? Because at the end of the day, all these activities are about improving the quality of life. So it is about running the conducting workshops. Also, at the same time, capacitating the counselors. I'm coming from a space of public administration. As a counselor, what is my role? We've got ward committees that are nominated in the communities, where you find that a member of a ward committee does not know the role that he or she must play. So for me, again, it is important that we also raise that awareness to the ward committees, where we're saying, as a ward committee, your role, you serve as a link between the community that has nominated you and a municipality. If there are any bylaws that are to be introduced, the people that you're representing must know that there is a particular bylaw that is in the pipeline. What can be our contribution as a ward councillor? What is my role? Is it about me or the needs of this particular community that I am representing? And I always say that in these public meetings, when I teach my students, when they call for the public meetings, isn't this one? People have lost trust, and I'm one of those. I do not attend these public meetings. Reason being, it is about all these promises which are made, which are not fulfilled. And for me, it's not about me, but it is about the poor of the poorest, which again, it is what the Constitution wants to realize at the end of the day. So when these meetings are held, it is our responsibility as a community that we attend these meetings. We express our views in terms of how can the municipality implement whatever that we feel is a priority to us. But the gap is, the municipal officials are on the other side, ensuring compliance. Mm-hmm. They are there just to wrap us up. As a community, we've lost hope. There have been a lot of promises that have been made. So you find that 30% of the people no longer attend the meetings, where the decisions to be made at the end of the day are going to affect me as a member of the Etegwini municipality. So for me, I think that is the gap that my research is also trying to fill in terms of making sure, capacitating the community, saying, you have a vote in your hand. Use it. Ensure that you participate in the space of decision making.
Now, your area of research is complete, has another layer of complexity, and that is the climate change. How does your research bridge the gap between climate change and grassroots awareness to empower local communities?
Climate change is also another animal, we can say it's an animal, which is here to stay.
Yeah.
And I think also, communities must be capacitated in terms of saying, for me, my focus, it is on the disaster risk reduction. Mm-hmm. How can these disasters be reduced? How do we capacitate communities in terms of saying there is climate change? Whenever there are floods, for instance, you find that the early warning systems which are used, sometimes the very same warning systems which are communicated with communities, they do not understand what does it mean if we are told that we are going to be at level 7.
Yeah.
So teaching communities in terms of climate change and say to the community, this is climate change and these are the consequences of climate change. How does it impact me as an individual? What should be my response if there is a warning? There's I always say that it's always taken for granted that there should always be total reliance on the West. There is indigenous knowledge that exists in these communities, which is still working today, even if there are these new systems which are used. Also, recognizing the existence of the indigenous knowledge, for me, it is also key. You know, in the past, they used to say, if the clouds were gathering, they would say, "Qoqa abafani induku," to stop the rain, of which today that is no longer done. It is about saying, make sure that you do not go out if there is no need. Make sure that you don't do A, B, C, D, and E. But recognizing the rich knowledge that exists in communities, it is very important for me. So the human settlements, maybe I need also to say this. When we started as a country, it started as housing, where it was about building the walls. And then it was then changed to human settlements, where it is now about using an integrated approach. We have these informal settlements, which are built in hazardous areas. Some are close to the rivers. Those, again, are a problem. Some are not. There's a program which was adopted by government, which is about upgrading of the informal settlements, where, again, it's all about the dignity. The issue of dignity is always at the center, where now it's about making sure that, okay, these people are living in the informal settlements. As a municipality, we can't do anything because there's a land shortage. The land that is vacant that we see, some of it's not buildable. Some of it, it's owned by private individuals. At some point, we had the willing buyer, the willing seller approach. It didn't work because sellers were charging high prices for the land. And some of the land is owned by provincial government. Some it's owned by municipalities. So again, that process, the planning process takes long. So in those areas, the upgrading of the informal settlement program, again, it does assist in making sure that the very same people do have access to the proper infrastructure, which is what is needed. And then those that are close to the river banks, they are a problem when it comes to the floods or whatever disaster. We've got, let me start with the issue of fires in the informal settlements. There's one here in Kennedy Road. We always see fires being reported because of how those informal settlements are built. And there's a lot of research that has been conducted where some of the people are being told that you are now going to be removed from this area to another area. Some they deny because they don't want to lose their social networks, which is also important. And some they'll want to go, but only to find that once they are there, it's not what they were expecting. So to live within your community, again, it is important. We've had floods in KZN 2002. Some we did have them in 2025. There was a lot of damage in terms of the infrastructure. If the infrastructure is damaged, again, there's going to be displacement. Again, the same problem. Government does not have enough money to accommodate the people who are displaced. Municipalities, once an area has been declared as a disaster area, they depend on the provincial government for support. We still have communities that are still living in community halls, which were affected by the floods in 2022. There's a housing development that is already in the pipeline. There's a community that has been identified in the different informal settlements. You cannot accommodate these that those that have been affected by the floods in 2022, whereas you know that the list is long. There is a waiting list. So this problem, it is there, but the solution for me and on the research that I am working on, maybe I need also to say I was in the US through the Fulbright program last year. What I was looking at was the issue of housing. Sometimes we think when we, because when we're in South Africa, we'll say that the housing challenges that we see in this country are only affecting South Africa. They are global. The US is also struggling in terms of housing delivery, but their approach is different. Mm. Our approach is also different, guided by Section 26 of the Constitution. Housing is a human right. But how are they able to address the issue? It is the involvement of the private sector, to allow the private sector to participate in the housing sector. Our approach, we've got municipalities are developers. So what happens, it is that, again, they are accredited by national government, not all of them, because of their capacity. The metros, they've been delegated with the function of housing, so they'll get the money to build the walls. If you are accredited, you build the walls. In providing the basic services, you use your revenue that you've collected as a municipality. Now, what is happening, then they look for contractors to do the job. Mm. What the contractors do, they build and then leave the project. Mm. The approach of involving the private sector, which is done in the US, they'll go in this housing sector space to make an investment. Private sector does not want to invest if they are not clear in terms of the returns. Mm. They're there to make profits. So there's also the low-income tax credits. I've written a paper on that one with a colleague in the US, where we're looking at how can South Africa also implement the low-income tax credits. Again, within this space of saying housing is a human right, what will be the benefits of the private sector? The gains for the private sector are important, because if you leave it with the municipalities do not have the capacity. No, in fact, for me, I always say they've been set up for failure. So we've got the exclusive functions as well as the concurrent functions as per the constitution. So the delegation of powers for the municipalities, they become enough in terms of saying they are struggling with what has been assigned to them. At the same time, they're expected to do what has been assigned to them by the other two spheres of government. So dealing with housing issues, for me, I'm looking at how can the private sector come on board. The civil society organizations, they play a very important role. They are representing their constituencies. They should also be part of the system. When there is a housing development that is proposed, for me, all stakeholders, yes, they must be involved from the conceptualization stage.
Again, I can't say this enough. Your area of research is very critical given our context in South Africa and all the challenges that we are facing in as far as human settlements is concerned. And there can never be enough researchers like yourself to help with policy changes and educational campaigns in some instances. So my question is, how then do you try to use your position as a researcher at MET to help other emerging researchers in your faculty to be part of this research niche area?
I think for me, I've I've had the advantage of seeing the need that you are, that we are sharing here, where I've started to work with colleagues. Okay, let me say that at some point at MUT, we once had a human settlements chair.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so the chair was headed by one of the scholars, and again at that time they were even in the focus areas of the university. Human settlements was also part of those focus areas.
Mm-hmm.
So. And the, and so what I am doing currently, as I was once a senior lecturer, one of the responsibilities, it is to mentor junior staff members.
Mm-hmm.
In the mentoring process, I've also encouraged colleagues to also be involved in this space of housing.
Yeah.
They've presented papers in the conferences. Next week, we will be attending a conference which is hosted by the US Africa Collaborative. It's a Penn City Summit. I'm a board member for that collaborative. So the focus of the collaborative, it is to look at the housing strategies across Africa, across the world, because we also have other members from Europe,
mm-hmm.
but it's mostly US as well as the African states. So we're also looking at innovative approaches. There is also this issue of alternative building technologies. When you look at South Africa, the focus when it comes to the construction of houses, it's more on bricks and mortar.
Yeah.
So we know that the norms and standards are approved by national government. But also government is realizing that in order for us as a country to address this huge housing backlog, they need also to approach the rules of alternative building technologies. So where it is about, what are the other building materials that can be used to build houses? So the collaborative, it is about that. There's also the concept of smart cities that has now been introduced because of the technology that is now in the space of housing. So there's a lot that one is learning.
Mm.
So you find that also there are these houses, the pilots which are showed, which are built using 3D. It's also another strategy that is used to make sure that the housing backlog in the country is reduced. So I do help colleagues. We next week, I think six of us, yes, we'll be attending that conference. And the papers that we'll be presenting, they are on rural integration, they're on climate change, they're on housing delivery, and so forth.
How does your work align with Ignite 2030?
Yes, that is our strategy. if you look at the goals... The goals, it talks about strategic partnerships.
Yeah.
Goal four. As I did say, in terms of strategic partnership, I'll start with national partnerships. Yesterday, I attended a meeting with, it emanated from the presentation in terms of our project that we presented at SASOF M-Day.
Mm-hmm.
M-Day, yes. And then... colleagues from UNISA, from UKZN, and there's also another colleague. We then felt that we need to meet with the Eteguini municipality so that we hear what the initiatives that the city is coming with and what are the challenges. So yesterday we met. We then discussed with the city the challenges that the city is facing in terms of housing development. And fortunately, MUT was in that meeting was also assigned a project where the colleagues said, as MUT, we need to focus on multi-stakeholder partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also brought in by this project that you are doing at Konobe, which we presented at SASUF. Partnerships, again, that we have as a department, we do have them with the legislature, provincial legislature. And that, again, came in through our advisory board meetings. We do have partnerships as a department with the Office of the Premier. Mm-hmm. In the last advisory board that we had last week, yes, there was a colleague from COCTA. Mm-hmm. Again, COCTA administers municipalities. In that meeting, again, it was agreed that the departments must meet with COCTA so that we identify the areas that are strategic to COCTA that the department can also contribute in giving support to the municipalities, and that is national. Internationally, as I've said, I'm part of the US-Africa Collaborative. When I was next week again, I will be facilitating a session on women in leadership and housing, where we are also looking at how can women be part or participate in the housing sector. We will also host the former Minister of Human Settlements. So if you read the BNG, the Breaking New Ground, it also talks about not leaving women behind. So how can women also participate in this space? In the US, I also met women who are developers, but with us, you find a few of them who participate. Mm. And then also, I'm currently working, I'm trying to establish an MOU with a chair at the University of Maryland, because that's where I was hosted. Mm. A chair where we're looking at social issues of social cohesion. And I did share with them the proposal where it was saying, let us look at how can we revitalize communities. And some of the challenges that we are facing with us as a country, it is that this high rate of unemployment, it can be reduced if communities can be capacitated. There was a project of self-help where communities were allowed to participate in building these houses. So when I'm part of the project, I'm going to learn skills. If I wasn't a builder before, once I'm told being part of the project, I will learn to build. Once the project is completed, I can be able to do my own job. So these strategies, the partnerships for me, they are very important, because for me, it's all about learning best practices. Yeah. Learning best practices. How can we do better as a country? But at the same time, knowing that housing in South Africa is a human right.
You know, I'm going to ask you one last question, but I think I know the answer already. What excites you most about the future of research at MUT?
If you look at our values, my MUT, yearning for growth, that for me, it says the ground for us is leveled to thrive. And as MUT researchers, we need to, research is about identifying a gap.
Yeah.
And then work on that gap, try to bring solutions on the gap that you have identified. The diverse community that we deal with, it says that we cannot come with a one-size-fits-all solution. But for me, it is about understanding better that this particular community requires this particular service. So as researchers at MUT, and again, having the management, which is also about us, because I think at all times it should always be, as we are saying, it should always be about the people. So they are saying to us as researchers, let us go all out and make sure that we provide solutions where there are problems. The opportunities are there for us to grow. We might not have postgraduate qualifications
for now.
Mm-hmm. But for me, what I always say, it is that from the networks that we have established, and that is what I have done, from the networks that we have established, let us also make use of that space. Mm-hmm. Whatever that we learn there, we'll bring it back to MUT. And also, we need to bear in mind that there's a lot that the outside community can learn from us. So the future is bright for MUT. Researchers must join this work on. It is moving. The My MUT approach, it is saying, wherever I am, in whatever that I am doing, I am a brand for MUT.
On that note, thank you very much, Dr. Mvuyani. Your research resonates, like I said, with many South Africans' lived experiences. Thank you for engaging us on this important topic. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for watching. Until next time, goodbye.
This is an MUT Radio podcast.